Welcome to the last installment of This Mind Itself is Buddha. And welcome, Liz, to the first and last. Luckily, this is the best part. There may be a sequel. There's much potential for sequels. Investigating mind with mind, day by day. I hope that such investigation of mind, study of the mind, and study of Buddha is joyful for you good disciples of Buddha. Even if we can't understand it in the end, even if all the bits and pieces of mind are dribbling through our fingers as we try to hold them, I hope there's some enjoyment in this communal investigation we're doing together. I must say that for me, this is very enjoyable, and we don't know where it's going, if anywhere, but the very investigation is seems to have effects. After Dogen has brought up the views of Seneca extensively and cut them down as heretical dharma, and brought up phrase by phrase, this very mind itself is Buddha. And then Dogen said, the mind that has been authentically transmitted is one mind is all things are one mind. One mind is all phenomena, all dharmas, and all dharmas are one mind. And one mind is one of the classic Zen teachings, maybe made most well known through the teachings of Huang Bo, a couple of generations after Matsu, so still in this time period. Matsu's disciple was Baijiang, and Baijiang's disciple was Huang Bo. And Huang Bo's collection of writing is called The Transmission of Mind. And he says, all Buddhas and all living beings are only one mind. There is no other reality. All Buddhas and all living beings are only one mind. There is no other reality. And he doesn't specify whether this one mind is like a universal one mind of the universe, or whether we're talking about this particular one mind that's hearing those words. Why the emphasis on one mind? All Buddhas and all living beings are only one mind. And it's a kind of an all-encompassing statement. These three equivalents that are usually seem to be different. There's all Buddhas and all sentient beings. Usually, you know, traditionally would be like opposites. There's sentient beings that are deluded, and then there's Buddhas that are awakened. And then there's mind, and this very mind is Buddha, but also this very mind is all living beings. All Buddhas and all beings are only one mind. There's no other reality. And now that we've heard the views of Seneca, as I mentioned yesterday, I feel like Huangbo flirts a little bit with the view of Seneca. It's, see what you think. Now that you've heard, some of you, Seneca's teaching that sounds somewhat like accurate Dharma, but had some problems. This mind, this one mind, from beginninglessness, has never been born and never passed away. Well, that's a relief. It's neither blue nor yellow. You thought it might have been a yellow mind. But it's just not any color or form. It has no shape and no form. It does not belong to existence or non-existence. It does not count as new or old. It is neither long nor short, neither large nor small. It transcends all limiting measurements, all labels, all traces, oppositions. So that's a bunch of negation, all of what it's not, the usual mode. It transcends all limiting measurements, all labels, all traces, all oppositions. This very being is it. When you stir thoughts, you turn away from it. It's like space, which has no boundaries and cannot be measured. So it seems like, though it's beyond all kinds of conceptual categories, this very being is it. But when we stir thoughts, when the conceptual mind, discriminating mind, is active, we turn away from it. So I have this sense that it's very immediate, accessible, and yet we're almost continuously running the stream of discursive, conceptual, discriminating mind, so we miss it. We miss appreciating it. It's not exactly that we're missing it, because this very being is it. Here it is. But we turn away from appreciating it. It is like space, which has no boundaries and cannot be measured. This one mind is itself Buddha. Buddha and sentient beings are no different. It's just that sentient beings seek externally, grasping appearances, losing the more they seek. They're no different, really. It's just that sentient beings seek externally and grasp appearances as real. But at any given moment of not grasping appearances as real, that would be Buddha. Thus, all Buddhas and all beings are just one mind. But this grasping at external appearances obscures the Buddha mind. If you try to have Buddha seek Buddha or use mind to grasp mind, you will never succeed. So, maybe we should stop talking about this now. If we're using mind to grasp mind. But can we hear these words like the lover outside the window of this room where she's calling to her maid, little Jade. So the words are not it, but when we hear the words, we can maybe recognize the sound of our lover's voice, not what she's saying. When you don't realize, what you don't realize is that if you stop thought and forget ruminations, the Buddha spontaneously appears. Mind itself is Buddha. Buddhas are sentient beings. As sentient beings, this mind is not diminished. As Buddhas, this mind is not increased. So I think this is beautiful clarification of this mind. It's easy to start thinking, well, sentient beings, we're diminishing this Buddha mind by our conceptual thinking that's obscuring it. But actually, it doesn't diminish this one mind in the least. And Buddhas don't, you know, enhance the one mind. Even the six perfections, myriad practices, and countless virtues are inherent, already naturally so, and do not need to be added by cultivation. When the appropriate circumstances are encountered, they are employed, and when those circumstances end, they rest. If you do not believe, trust with certainty that this is Buddha, and want to cultivate practice bound up with forms in order to seek effective application, this is all illusion, contrary to the way. This mind itself is Buddha. There's no other Buddha and no other mind. Mind is clear and pure as space, with no appearance at all. But when you arouse the mind and stir thoughts, you turn away from the essence of its reality. This is attachment to appearances. There has never been Buddhahood attached to appearances. If you cultivate the myriad practices of the six perfections in quest of Buddhahood, this is a gradual procedure. But there has never been Buddhahood as a gradual procedure. Just realize the one mind, and there's nothing else at all to attain. This is real Buddha. So, classic Zen Southern School teaching. I think Huang Bo is a devoted practitioner and practiced various forms as a monk living in the monastery. And yet, he's making this point about any particular cultivation of any particular practices in order to create Buddha mind is all off track, because this one mind, is this very being, is it. There's nothing to create. We can't even escape from it, but we can avoid it, and we can obscure it and turn away from it and not trust it. We can think, this kind of thing sounds good, but isn't this some kind of like a shortcut that's too easy? It's like so frighteningly simple. Not exactly easy, right? But frighteningly simple that we often can't stand it, I think. So then we think, that's too much. It's like, it's right here, right now, but I feel so deluded and obscured and messed up. So let's practice the six paramitas. And I would say that, you know, Pongo wouldn't say, you know, don't practice giving and precepts and patience and enthusiasm and meditation. It's just, don't practice them with this idea of gaining a Buddha mind that we don't already have. Which is often how we do think about it, I think. At least to some extent. Even if we've heard this kind of teaching, I think still we feel like, secretly, we're like, I know this is already it, but like, let's improve our practice a little bit also. And I think it's a key point that he says, you know, if you do not trust or believe with certainty that this is Buddha, then we'll naturally want to cultivate practice bound up with forms. And in a way, this is like the innermost heart of Zen teachings, and could be dangerous, because you can hear this kind of thing superficially and say, well, then we don't need, what, look at this sesshin, like all these details of form. Like, let's forget it. We're be Buddha right now and whatever form it takes. And which reminds me of a story about Huang Bo that I think helps demonstrate this point. It happens to be Huang Bo who continuously, and as this piece goes on, is somewhat critical of any kind of like gradual cultivation of practices. But there's this one story about one time he was at the altar bowing. He was doing a form, a traditional practice form. He was doing prostrations, and a novice who would later become the emperor of China, and I think they knew that he was temporarily a novice monk, but he was going to be the emperor. So there was, you know, people respected him highly because you don't mess with the emperor. But he was a novice monk, and he was quite, because he was training to be the emperor, he was maybe a little bit haughty and pushy. So he saw Huang Bo bowing and said to him something like, "You always teach that there's no Buddha to seek. Don't seek Buddha because Buddha's right here. So what are you seeking by doing these bows?" And Huang Bo stopped bowing and said, "Not seeking, I bow." And I think, I can't remember exactly the details, but something like, bowing to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, not seeking. And I think maybe at that point, Huang Bo, as they often did in those days, slapped him, just to drive the point home, slapped the future emperor, which was a pretty taboo thing. And this novice future emperor said, "How coarse!" And Huang Bo said, "What? You're making a distinction between fine and coarse?" And slapped him again. But it looks like Huang Bo devotedly practiced forms, but he was just very adamant about how to practice them. With the perspective of the one mind. All Buddhas and all living beings are only one mind. That's a nice refrigerator quote. So back to Dogen. Oh, we talked about yesterday, if you realize this mind, there's not an inch of land left on earth. And know that when you realize this mind, the entire sky collapses and the whole earth explodes. Or, if you realize this mind, the earth raises its surface by 3 inches. So, the next section is on the ancient masters Yangshan and Guishan, who are the founders of the Guiyang school. There's 5 schools or houses of Zen in old China after the time of the sixth ancestor, and the ones that we know of today because they lasted are the Shaodong and Linji lineages in China, Shaodong and Linji in Japanese, Soto and Rinzai, and those are 2 of these 5 schools that have miraculously carried on down to Santa Cruz, California from the Tang Dynasty China. I mean, when you really think about that, there's something, I think, kind of miraculous about the something, I don't want to say the power of Dharma that makes that possible, but something about it, right, that it didn't just like die out and fade into obscurity. And the other three lineages, in a way, did fade off into obscurity. But not that they're any less. Their teaching style, it may be more, you know, in some ways we could say maybe that they were subtler, and their standards maybe were higher, such that that teachers at the end of those lines didn't feel like they could no one was ready to continue passing on that particular style of the Yunnan lineage, the Guiyang, based on Guishan and Yangshan lineage, and the Fayan lineage. Guiyang school of Guishan and Yangshan, his student, is particularly characterized by many dialogues between Guishan and Yangshan. A lot of conversations between this teacher and student, and where it's not even so clear sometimes who's a teacher and student. These were recorded, and they're also, this lineage is known as using symbols and like kind of visual diagrams and symbols, and you can find some cases in the Book of Serenity where they kind of draw things on the ground or in the air and play with them like this. So Yangshan and Guishan said to each other, it was really Guishan says, "What is the wondrous clear mind?" And Yangshan says, "I say it is mountains, rivers, and earth. It is the sun, the moon, and stars." And it's with part of a slightly longer dialogue, which is case number 168 in Dogen's 300 koan collection. Which is called sometimes called the Chinese Shobogenzo. Dogen's got various Shobogenzos, right? There's the main 95 fascicle Shobogenzo that's the most well-known of which we're studying right now, with longer, 95 longer essays. Then Dogen has the Shobogenzo Record of Things Heard, Zui Monki, which are these informal conversations with his students, which I've been bringing up recently on Wednesday nights. And then there's this third Shobogenzo. You'd think he could have gotten a little more creative with the titles. There's a third, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, that's just a collection of 300 koan stories translated by Kaz Tanahashi and Daido Lori Roshi. And he didn't do any verses or commentaries with this. He just collected his favorite stories, and they're often the ones that appear in the longer Shobogenzo. So it could have been that this was like his kind of notes for writing the essays of the Shobogenzo.
Are these in
the Eihei Koroku? There's another koan collection in the Eihei Koroku. There's one of the books, I think, is 100 koans.
So that is an addition.
That's an addition. Yeah.
Okay.
And in the Eihei Koroku, the extensive record, he does write verse comments on, you know, another collection of koans. I think maybe 100 there, and I haven't looked, but there's probably a lot of overlap, and a lot of these appear in, like, the Blue Cliff Record and the Book of Serenity. But since there's 300, there's a lot of more interesting and unknown or less known stories, and, I kind of feel like Dogen just, you know, as he went through all these long records of different stories, he just wrote down his favorites. So number 168 is called Yangshan's Inconceivable Clear Bright Mind. Guishan asked Yangshan, "How do you understand inconceivable clear bright mind?" And Yangshan said, mountains, rivers, the great earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars. And so, but it goes on. Guishan said, you only understand things. You know, this, you're talking about things. I asked about mind. And Yangshan says, Master, what did you just ask me? And Guishan repeats the question, how do you understand inconceivable, clear, bright mind? And Yangshan says, can you call that things? And Guishan said, that's it, that's it. So, this I invite you to take up this story on your own when it's spending some time with it myself. I feel like it's kind of like a steep wall. This story, I feel. I'll read again. How do you understand inconceivable, clear, bright mind? Yangshan said, mountains, rivers, the great earth, the sun, the moon, and stars. Guishan said, you only understand things. I think this is an important part, though, that we can see. That's a nice little addition there that we can look at in terms of the story. Master, what did you just ask me? How do you understand inconceivable, clear, bright mind? And Yangshan said, can you call that things? That, meaning like, is he talking about, is that referring to clear, bright mind? Or that statement? Can you call that things? And Guishan, sounds like he approved him by asking that question, saying, that's it, that's it. But, and Daido Lori Roshi's commentary says, mountains, rivers, the great earth, sun, moon, and stars are not things. The inconceivable, clear, bright mind is not a thing. So, that's maybe, we could see the gist of it there, is, you know, how do you understand inconceivable, clear, bright mind? Yangshan said, can you call that things? So, you know, and is that any less thingified than mountains, rivers, and earth? Or any more thingified? Are we, you know, if you call mountains, rivers, and earth thing, then can you call that mind a thing? And Daido Lori goes on, when we clearly understand the identity of seer and seen, we then realize the mountains, rivers, the great earth, the sun, the moon, and stars are mind itself. However, this does not mean that they're inside the mind, nor can it be said that they're outside the mind. Then where can they be found? And where can mind be found? So, this whole next section here now, that Dogen's finishing this essay with, is about what appears to be things, and saying that they're mind. So it's kind of a turn in this essay. It feels like to me, after saying mind is not all these different kinds of consciousness and even very subtle but dualistic consciousnesses, and so we're starting, my sense is where the investigating mind starts to feel like, oh, we're talking about this very subtle, completely inconceivable, very deep and mysterious source kind of mind. And now he's kind of like leaping back in the other direction and saying, actually, now mind is like mountains, rivers, and earth. It has that effect, I feel like, looking inward more and more, and then suddenly, actually, you know, don't look there. Mm-hmm. Mountains, rivers, and earth. Mm-hmm. But then we have to be careful now, what are those things? And so this point about Guishan, or Yangshan, Guishan saying, those are just things, is very similar to a story about Jiaozhou that you probably have heard this the classic story. What is the meaning or the intent? We can maybe even stretch it to say intent, to say the mind of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. The character used there is not exactly the same as mind, but it's more like intent. But it contains the radical for mind. It could say it's some quality of Bodhidharma's intention from coming to the West. What is the intent of Bodhidharma coming from the West? The classic Zen question. And Jiaozhou says, the oak tree in the garden. One of Jiaozhou's famous lines. Or the cypress tree in the garden. And often the koan is recorded just like that. That's the whole story. What's the intention of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Or, you know, Thomas Cleary likes it translated as, what is the living meaning of Zen? It's just the poetic way of asking that is, what's the intention of Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen, coming to China? The oak tree in the garden, the cypress tree in the garden. Maybe cypress tree. Because actually there's I visited Jiaozhou's monastery in China, and it's called Cypress Forest Monastery. And there's cypress trees all over the grounds, and some of them are like really ancient, and I think the monks there are like, we're trying to kind of date them to see if they actually were here at the time of Jiaozhou. Because people say, well, he's just, you know, they're sitting in a cypress grove, or he's looking at a cypress tree when he says that. And, you know, we don't know, like, were these descendants of those cypress trees there? Or did they plant them because the saying of Jiaozhou was famous? They're like, let's plant some Jiaozhou cypress trees and name, I think the name probably came later. Cypress Forest Monastery was probably named after this story became well known. So it often ends there. What's the intent of Bodhidharma? Mind of Bodhidharma, cypress tree in the garden. And then the monk who asked the question says, don't teach by means of objects, which is like, that's a thing. I think what do you mean the mind of Bodhidharma is this, you know, external object, is this thing called the cypress tree in the garden. Teacher, don't guide people by using objects. Something like that is what he says. And Jiaozhou says, I don't teach people by using objects. And then so then he asks, well then, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma's, the intent of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? And he says, the cypress tree in the garden. That's the extended version of the story. So, and I think it's a similar point about this is that, and this is the abbreviated one is just that Dogen quotes here is, what is wondrous clear mind? I say it's mountains, rivers, and earth, sun, moon, and stars. Both versions have this extended clarification of, that's a thing, those are things, and the cypress tree is an object. Yes?
But the lady pointed out that the sandalwood is due to the ancestors. In the same way, the cypress tree is due to the ancestor. Like in the world of interconnectedness, nothing happens, even if it's on the other side of the globe, without that was there. So us having a road here is due to Jesus Christ being born. In the world of interconnectedness.
Mm. So therefore, how could that be the mind? Is that the mind? The intention?
So how do you differentiate between a thought, like you said about the garden, being an intent and being made an intention?
Mm-hmm.
So how does a thought differentiate from the object?
Yeah, especially if we're talking about intention. Intention creates the world. And the world of what seems like objects. and the appearances of the objective world is created by intent and mind, you know, at different levels. I think the Abhidharma Kosha chapter on karma, which is karma is defined as intention. Maybe, Shoho, do you know this? Does it start with the sentence, karma creates the world? I think that would be the first sentence of the chapter on karma. Karma creates the world, which is like saying intention creates the world, which is kind of like saying mind creates the world, but it's, now we're getting into another, a different territory of mind-only school. Abhidharma is, you know, pre-mind-only. Yeah.
I wanted to ask if in the original text there is the word like. In other words, is it a simile? The mind is like, not in the world.
No.
Or is it an identity?
Identity. Yeah.
Could make a huge difference.
Yes.
Whether or not we consider it a simile.
Yeah, no. I think that's what's so radical about it, is it's a direct identity. This mind is mountains, rivers, and earth. Yeah. To say like would make a huge difference, and it would be much easier to get a hold of. Yeah, it's kind of like that. But actually, mind is. I think these statements are very provocative because of this. They seem to be talking about objects, and yet, this point that actually. What are objects? What is the, what are things? What is the world? What are cypress trees? which, you know, there's many ways we could talk about this, and recently we've been talking about Nagarjuna, so there would be a way of saying that actually a cypress tree is a conceptual, you know, mind-created object. There's not, cypress tree depends on mental imputation, mental construction. Is there something before mental construction where we see a cypress tree? And like, in the end, if we look really deeply, we can't even say if there's anything there. You know, scientifically we'd say, well, there must be. But actually, experientially, we can never, we can't experientially prove that there's any objective world in any way that we know it, as like sun and stars and moon, without mind to mentally impute using names and concepts. And you know, this is very difficult point, I think, because we can get into saying, well, what about if we don't have a name for the moon, still we see a moon, but we don't really see a moon, right? We see something, and even if one were to say, well, this is just playing with words, and really, even if we didn't have a name, we'd still see something. But actually, it's not just the name, it's not just the word, it's the way that words are like used to break the, you know, undifferentiated universe into things. And so even if we don't have specific words, still the mind is designed to like, you know, differentiate edges of things, you know, and yes.
Well, because once we have a word on it, then we think we know what it is, and then we close ourselves to all the other things that it could be.
Yeah.
You know, and I think culturally, when we experience different cultures and we see the ways that different cultures use language in really different ways to talk about the universe, I think just that is a hint at how limiting it is.
Yeah.
Luminous silver thing, because I know what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes, exactly. And that reminds me of this friend of mine, Steve Harper. Maybe there's no Steve.
I don't know his name.
He does these wilderness hikes around. He lives in Big Sur and does them there. So at Tassajara, we did some like hiking and Zen workshops for several summers, and he's done them many, many summers. And he's a naturalist and knows all the plants in the Ventana wilderness completely, and sees all kinds of things that non-botanists wouldn't see. But it's supposed to be a meditative, experiential, silent hike. It's quite wonderful, these workshops. And one of his guidelines is, people are walking and they see these, you know, an amazing bright red flower or something, and they'll say, what's this one? And he won't tell people. He knows the names of all of them. And he's like, later, at the end of the hike, I'll tell you the names of all these things, but I don't want to say that, because as soon as I say, oh, it's Indian paintbrush, then we immediately, just like you said, we just like classify it. We stop seeing it, actually. Oh yeah, okay, got it now. It's an Indian paintbrush. Like we're not seeing it for what it is. We're like categorizing it by this particular name. And I noticed that even after he said we're going to do this, we're going to experience them, and he'd be constantly picking up plants and having everybody smell them and feel them and sometimes taste them, and sensory experiencing of the world, but not naming. And I found my tendency was like, I couldn't help it. I'd say like, oh, what's that one? Like, like it's so, you know, the mind works that way so strongly. We want to know, get a conceptual grip on things.
I'm remembering many, many years ago when we were doing sashin up at Jokoji, and they had this chalkboard in the community room, and somebody had written up there, Patrick, you probably remember this because you were back around then. It said, at last, this purple flower, I have forgotten its name. And that whole sashin was sort of, I think Kathleen worked it into the Dharma talk at some point.
Also a little bit like in the realm of haiku and poems, what is that like, something like sitting in a park in the capital, dreaming about being in the capital, or dreaming about going to the capital.
Longing for Kyoto in Kyoto.
Yeah, that's it, I think, yeah. Like some idea of Kyoto other than the one that we're in. Kind of like some idea of mind other than this very being. Yes.
Two comments. One about the moon. When we, for instance, that we were saying that, say in Korea, it's not a man in the moon but a rabbit in the moon, that helps us right away to let go of certain notions. And then I still want to sort of put in a plea for words.
Please don't misunderstand me.
I can see both sides and all and in between, because there are ways in which, as we all know, we use words just the same, knowing of the limitations and of the that there could be other ways, but if we use them but without attaching so to them and think, well, there could be others, but for now this may point the way to, you know, and the lover may hear. Is that kind of use of words?
Definitely, because look at Dogen, right? Mm-hmm. Thousands and thousands of pages of words. But that are often used in strange ways that point either directly or quite indirectly to something beyond words. But definitely, I think words are actually the only way, the Buddha Dharma is basically words. And I think the only way to be free from our grasping at concepts which have to do with words is to use words. Otherwise, we can't just say, we'll just forget it. I mean, we live in the world of words. Yes.
Well, I think that's why they go, you know, to such an extent to just be constantly contradicted, just to help us not get caught by the words. Like, you know, like you were saying, Matsu says, you know, mind is Buddha, mind is Buddha. Oh, his teaching has changed. Now it's not mind, mm-hmm. it's not Buddha. You know, using words to help us not get attached to words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially the koan stories are really playing like that.
I think long ago, a talk here, when Catherine was speaking about language and expressing a certain cautionary attitude, even one might say a distrust, I thought of the French philosopher Jacques Derrida, D-E-R-R-I-D-A, for those who don't know him, who suggested a very interesting Zen-like use of words, concepts, which are useful for the time being, but you run a line through them, a diagonal line, like the crossing out of smoking or whatever, so that you use them for the time being with an awareness of their limitations and that they may have to be jettisoned, but for the time being.
Yeah, they're skillful means.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yes.
So, kind of trying to summarize the teaching here, it sounds like, I mean, about the cypress tree and just the whole discussion about that, it sounds like, is it fair to say that all that is experienced, everything that is experienced is mind? And therefore, in this teaching, since this mind is Buddha, that's the same as saying all that is seen is empty. Emptiness, you define that Buddha as realized emptiness. Right? So is that?
It's empty because.
Because it doesn't exist on its own. It's not. Mm. It doesn't have separate substantiality. Mm. Or it doesn't have substantiality at all.
And particularly, like, independent of words, in this case.
Yeah, independent of words or independent of, the observer trying to understand it.
Naming it and describing
it. Essentially, by naming it, lessening it. So the name cypress tree doesn't define it. It's actually mm-hmm. of cypress tree-ness.
Yeah.
Tree-ness.
And yet, isn't it interesting here that he, instead of saying mind is emptiness, he's doing this, using these skillful means of saying something more like the opposite. Mind is mountains, rivers, and earth to, maybe to keep us from just getting stuck in this view that like, of just emptiness in the negative sense of, everything is completely ungraspable and that's all there is to it. But actually, here's the positive side now. Mind is mountains, rivers, and earth. And it's going to get, I think, it gets even more provocative as it goes on. Thus we know that the mind is mountains, rivers, and earth. The mind is the sun, moon, and stars. What is said here is not more, not less. And then this phrase, the mountains, rivers, and the earth mind are just mountains, rivers, and earth. Or yet another translation says, mountains, rivers, and the earth as mind, because we've just said they're mind, mountains, rivers, and earth as mind are just the mountains, rivers, and earth. Seems to be making the point that like, of taking mind out of the picture completely. Mountains, rivers, and earth, mind, you know, we've equated them, and we said it's all mind only. It's kind of sounding like mountains, rivers, and earth are all mind only. So mountains, rivers, and earth, mind. But what is that? Instead of saying, you might, you know, I might expect it to say, Thus we know, mountains, rivers, and earth, mind, are just mind. But it says the opposite. Mountains, rivers, and earth, mind, are actually just the mountains, rivers, and earth themselves. You know, it's really making this point about the object, you know, kind of like apart from the mind. I think that's why this is, when I'm getting to that part, I thought, whoa, Dogen. No. Slow down. there are no extra waves or spray, you know, in this mind. And so this is a poetic way of saying nothing extra added to mountains. Or, you know, maybe a little off to say in this mind was just, it doesn't really say that. That's just the interpretation. It's in parentheses. We could say no extra waves or spray in the rivers. You know. The sun, moon, and stars' mind is just the sun, moon, and stars. There's no extra fog or mist. Beautiful images, I think, too. The coming and going of birth and death mind is just the coming and going of birth and death. There's no extra delusion or enlightenment. The walls, tiles, and pebbles mind is just the walls, tiles, and pebbles. There's no extra mud or water. The four great elements and the five skandhas mind are just the four great elements and five skandhas. There's no extra horse or monkey. And one footnote just says, it's like monkey mind, you know, and maybe images that sometimes might get used for crazy, deluded mind, and like the wild horse of mind. No extra horse or monkey. The chair and whisk mind is just the chair and whisk. There's no extra bamboo or wood. So that's kind of using the traditional Zen, like the Zen teaching chair and the, you know, fly whisk Zen tools. No extra bamboo or wood. So I think that whole paragraph is one of the real highlights here. It's just it's kind of, let's say, it seems to be pointing to not even bringing up any kind of conceptual idea of the mind that actually is these things. It's like the total simplicity of like just the phenomena world. It's kind of, or another way I could see it is, it's like the two-sided coin of mind only is one side, and objective phenomena world is the other side of the same coin. And you could say it's the same coin. You can either say everything is mind. Everything is this mind, for our unique experience of the world. Actually, there is no external world, there's just this mind. And then the flip side is, there's just the external world, there's no mind. You know, there's no extra mind there. There's just, we could say the mind only. We could also have mind only school. We could say there's like the world only school. The phenomenal world only. The world only. Phenomena only school. The thing only school. And I didn't really look into this, but I think there's... has anyone studied the 10 Oxfording pictures? I haven't looked at it recently, but I think there's these different stages, and isn't there something like, the ox is like Buddha mind, and then there's the Buddha mind in this case we could say the whole phenomenal world to stretch it. The ox is like mountains, rivers, and earth as Buddha, and then there's the person that like chasing the ox, right? And I think there's a part where it's like, person remaining, ox gone, mm-hmm. which could be like everything, there's just mind, there's just this unique experience. There's just me, in a way. There's just this mind. There is no external world, that anything outside is gone. And then there's another stage of like ox remaining and person gone. So if we, this is maybe stretching this image, but these two sides of, there's just the ox of mountains, rivers, and earth, but the person, the mind that's experiencing it is actually gone. It's like, there's nobody here. There's just, the perceiving mind has dissolved into totally absorbed in watching a sunset or something, like you can just disappear. And there's just the sunset. It's not, and which is a little bit different perspective than shifting back and like to more subjective experience in a way. To say subjective and objective is a little bit off, but roughly, like there is no sunset. It's just mind, which is a dharmic perspective. I think a liberating perspective, that there's no sunset out there. It's just the mind's creation. But then the other perspective of there's just the sunset, and the perceiving mind is like completely drops away, and there's just merging into the world. The self is gone. There's just the world, which is equally as liberating, but they're almost like opposites. Yeah.
There is no extra.
Yeah.
like letting yourself be, letting your mind be physically shaped by the words.
Mm.
I can just hear this, and somewhere that makes a difference. And maybe I'm not going to grasp something directly, or not grasp something conceptually, but just
Well, relaxation could be a realm of nothing extra, nothing added, nothing extra. So it could be that the repetition of there's no extra anything is kind of like, basically non-relaxation is adding something extra to the natural state of relaxation. So it could be that you're actually like, I don't exactly completely get this, but like I'm actually adding less and less extra as I keep hearing about there is nothing extra, and then that's just like relaxation. That's beautiful, yeah. Mm-hmm. Patrick.
So the extra would be something like, I really enjoyed that sunset.
Mm.
Yeah. Being there, enjoying it, and acknowledging it.
I think there's infinite forms of extra that we could add on. Enjoying it, even like, calling it a sunset even, could be subtly extra. Even saying the sunset is mine only, in this case, could be extra. It's kind of, I think he might even be, the mountains, rivers, and earth, mind, are just mountains, rivers, and earth. We don't need this extra thing of mind. It's like, and all the discussion about it. So it's nice as it gets near the end of this essay that it's like, it's something very, very simple. Just what is, without any extra. And extra could be, yeah, I like the sunset, or any kind of, when we're speaking of, again, going back to ordinary mind is the way. And what is ordinary mind? The mind of no grasping or rejecting. You could say those are the basic forms of extra. Those are what we add to ordinary mind to make it extra mind, extra spiffed up, painful mind. But ordinary mind, there is nothing extra. I think we also says in the Xinxin Ming, right, that we chant in the morning sometimes, the way is perfect, like vast space with nothing lacking and nothing extra. It's like, and that way we could call it, we could say the mind, mind itself as Buddha is perfect, like vast space with nothing lacking and nothing extra. And so, yeah, beautiful poetic images about these, you know, there's no waves or spray added to the river, and there's no fog or mist covering the moon and stars. There's no delusion or enlightenment added to birth and death. Now it's starting to get into the more like Buddhist ideas. So that one particular coming and going of birth and death mind, samsaric mind, is just samsaric mind. There's no extra delusion or enlightenment on top of the cycle of birth and death. How beautiful. And is that not the kind of explanation of birth and death is itself nirvana? This profound teaching that birth and death is itself nirvana. You could say, well, how is that so? This sentence maybe is a little commentary on how that's so. The coming and going of birth and death mind is just the coming and going of birth and death. There's no extra delusion or enlightenment added on top of that. Just the coming and going of births and deaths is free. Walls, tiles, and pebbles mind is just walls, tiles, and pebbles. No extra mud added to the layers of wall. And again, a Buddhist image of four great elements and five skandhas is like sometimes the physical and mental person. A person is just four great elements, earth, wind, fire, and water. In terms of the body, the form skandha is sometimes defined as the four great elements, earth, wind, fire, water, working in a particular way. Those are physical elements. And then the other four skandhas would be the mind skandhas. So four great elements and five skandhas. Mind are just four great elements and five skandhas. There's no extra horse or monkey, or we could say no, you know, to, you know, just be very blunt and straightforward. No extra grasping or rejecting. Five skandhas with no grasping or rejecting of the five skandhas is just five skandhas, is freedom. The chair and whisk mind in the end, just to throw in a Zen saying, chair and whisk mind is just chair and whisk. There's no extra bamboo or wood. And there's a lot of Zen stories about the, you know, the fly whisk and the teacher holding up the whisk and, you know, people make something special out of it. And, you know, do you identify with this action or not? Yeah, the teacher will say, and people will get stuck and like, you know, what is the meaning of this? I think there might even be one of the koans, and I can't remember at all who it would be, but one of the classic ones, I think, might even be like, hold up the whisk and like, what is it? And somebody says something like, it's, you know, it's Buddha's mind pervading the universe or something. And he said, no, it's the fly whisk. So, no extra bamboo or wood. This being so, mind itself is Buddha does not divide mind itself as Buddha. In any way, we could say doesn't divide mind itself is Buddha into like mind and Buddha, or into mind and things. Maybe particularly it's, if it's following this paragraph, it doesn't divide itself into the phenomenal world being mind, and then there's mind. It's like, we can either say there's just mind, period, or there's just the world, period. no extra mind, no extra world, no, not divided. Buddhas do not divide Buddhas. Thus, the mind itself as Buddha indicates Buddhas of aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana. Those who have not actualized aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana do not experience mind itself as Buddha. So here's his kind of like, now he's getting strict. After it's so, you know, it's so giving, right? It's so, here, this very being is it. And as Huangbo says, and now I think Dogen's just making the point, as we start to feel more and more free in this mind being Buddha, he brings up the kind of traditional path. Let's actually, there's a practice, you know. And aspiration, practice, this kind of sequential order, and it's getting into time. He's going to start getting into time here. First there's that bodhicitta, the aspiration for the way. Then there's practice, then there's enlightenment or realization, and then final nirvana. So even if you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment and actualize practice realization for a moment, that is the mind itself is Buddha. So now it feels, after that last sentence of like, whoa, we have to go through this whole path to actually realize. You know, he says, just for a moment. And this is, Dogen says, in the latest Santa Cruz newsletter. Practitioners today have to arouse deep aspiration for the way at least once. And then there's Kokyo's commentary. Says, I find it interesting that he says at least once. This was before reading this part too, that he's, you know, one moment of aspiration is mind itself as Buddha. So sincere practice and realization may be fully actualized, set in motion by, for just one moment, letting go of everything completely, surrendering totally, offering one's life to all beings and to the way, trusting that whatever happens from now on with such an attitude will be okay. For like, tiny, tiny moment. That sounds very grandiose to be able to really like let go of everything completely and surrender totally. But probably everybody's had moments of zazen where it's kind of like, okay, I give up. Just whatever happens for this moment. And if not, then maybe possible. Maybe not that, you know, not so far reaching. For just one moment to let go completely, and that is arousing such an aspiration. Dogen says, arousing such an aspiration means thinking little of your own life, having deep compassion for all living beings, and entrusting your bodily life to the Buddha's teaching. If you've already aroused such aspiration, protect it. Do not lose it even for a moment. It's impossible to realize Buddha Dharma without such an aspiration. Or here Dogen might say, it's impossible to realize this mind itself is Buddha without aspiration. And I've also recently been contemplating aspiration as the, talking about it in a more simple way of just really wanting to be free from whatever's binding us, which could be changing all the time what that is, but in any given moment, like really, like, I feel okay calling it like a wish and a want and a desire, not for some thing or some attainment, but more like to let go of something, to not, to be free from the things, whatever thing is, whatever mental, grasping is binding us, is preventing our freedom in any given moment. And playing with this idea that and this is something to, I'd be interested if people try this out, you know, and not necessarily in Zazen, but just in any moment of the day, but really sincerely, deeply, like wishing, wanting, especially when things are difficult, especially when we feel really not free, to just, instead of trying, start to work out some means to become free, just stop and be like, wait a second, I actually really want to be free right now. I have no idea how to go about it, or you might even feel, but just, I really want to be free. And I don't think it's a gaining idea if it's freedom, because freedom's not something to gain. It's just free from whatever's trapping us. And to, you know, further emphasize the non-gainingness of it, we can remember too that if we can be free for one moment, that would be the greatest gift to everybody else, actually. I don't even think we need to, I mean, it might help to remember, to contemplate how that's so, but I think we do know that already. We know that our grasping is actually the only way we actually can hurt others, I think. It's through our own grasping. So if we can release, and in some not in some abstract, big kind of way, but just a moment. So appreciating, he's saying, just one moment like this. And then that moment has effect for later. So even if you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, and, you know, if that sounds too grand, the aspiration to just be free from this self-clinging of the moment in this moment. He says, arouse the aspiration for enlightenment and actualize practice realization. Dogen's classic term. But almost like equating them, it sounds like to me, that one moment of aspiration for enlightenment is actualizing practice realization. And for one moment, that is mind itself is Buddha. And even if you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment and actualize practice realization within the most minute particle, within the most minute practice, that is mind itself is Buddha. So maybe that's like one step longer than a moment. Most minute, you know, little like span of practice, because then the next one is going to be, even if you arouse it and actualize it for innumerable kalpas, that itself is mind, is Buddha. So going from this one moment to innumerable eons, if you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment and actualize practice realization in a flash of thought, that is mind itself is Buddha. If you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment and practice and actualize practice realization within half a fist, that is mind itself is Buddha. Fist is just one of those Zen, strange Zen images, like nostrils. It's like, you know, the reality. Something like, you know, all-encompassing reality. Those who say that practicing for an eon to become a Buddha is not mind itself as Buddha, have not seen, known, and studied mind itself as Buddha. They have not met an authentic teacher who expounds mind itself as Buddha. So I think that, you know, I would have said, well, why doesn't he say, those who say that practicing for one moment to become a Buddha is not, but he says the practicing for an eon to become Buddha. And so it seems to me here, it's making the point that that for those who see this grand vision of eons of practice, that Dogen respects that, even though this is the sudden school, instant awakening in one moment. And so maybe people do cut down, like Huangbo, for one, I think does talk about later, he says, you know, this idea that you're practicing for three countless eons to awaken to the way. You can awaken to the way right now, and the way that you awaken right now will be exactly the same as what will happen in three countless eons. So why wait? kind of like that. So it's kind of Zen, the Zen party line is kind of a little bit like, a little bit cutting down three countless eons model of practice. But Dogen says, those who say that practicing for an eon to become Buddha is not mind itself as Buddha have not seen and known and studied mind itself as Buddha. So I hear that as, it's okay if it's one moment, it's okay if it's three countless eons, or one eon, or 5 minutes, or 17 hours, or any practice. And remember, practice and realization are not two. So three eons of practice, for Dogen, is three eons of verification or realization. Also, this thing about nothing extra, there's no extra anything added to mountains, rivers, and earth, no extra waves or spray, is so strikingly similar to this teaching of for Bahia that I think, did Harry bring this up yesterday? That about in the scene, there's just the scene. Yeah, so that sutra, just an early version of the same teaching as, you know, the sun, moon, and stars, mind is just the sun, moon, and stars. There's no extra fog or mist. Just to hear this short, complete sutra, that's the Bahia Sutra in the early Pali Canon. Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. We could say nothing extra is added. In the heard, merely what is heard. So in, you know, and really like in the seen, you could say, well, what, let's get specific. What are we looking at? Mountain and river. So in the mountains and rivers, there's just mountains and rivers. You should train yourself thus. You see how similar it can sound? In the heard, you're hearing, you know, the sound of the river. In the heard, there's just the heard, merely what is heard. In the sensed, there'll be merely what is sensed. In the cognized, will be merely what is cognized. So we could say thought, cognized thought, and I think they say this includes all the other senses that weren't already covered also, of this, the six senses. But in the thought, there's just the thought. So if we say mountains, rivers, and earth are just mind, are mind only, the three worlds are mind only, and then we combine that teaching, the mountains, rivers, and earth are mind only, with in the cognized, there will be merely what is cognized. Can you follow this? So then, in the mountains, rivers, and earth, there will be merely, you know, in the cognized mountains, rivers, and earth, there will be merely the cognized mountains, rivers, and earth. No, nothing extra. No extra grasping or rejecting, saying that they're mind or not mind, saying that they're things or not things, saying that they're the objective world or not the objective world, just the experience of the experience. When Bahia, in the seen, there is merely what is seen, down to in the cognized is merely what is cognized, then Bahia, you will not be with that. There's different translations here, but you will not be with that, and could take it as you will not be with that. You will not be something added extra to that cognition of the mountains, rivers, and earth. There would just be mountains, rivers, and earth without you being with them, with that. When you're not with that, you will not be in that. You will not start identifying with and putting yourself into the experience of that. When you're not in that Bahia, you will be neither here nor there nor in between. just this is the end of suffering. So this is one of Buddha's short and complete teachings. Many times he says, this is the end of suffering, but this isn't just a provisional practice leading up to something else. It's the whole works. So when walking by the mountains, rivers, and earth, there is just the cognized mountains, rivers, and earth, nothing extra. You will not be in them, you'll not be with them, you'll not be in them, and therefore you won't be here or there or in between. I could even say you won't be here, you won't be like in the mind, you won't be in the mountains, and you won't be in between. It's unlocatable. There's no place you are.
Is it like a transparency?
Like an unfindability, I would say. An unfindability. Transparency, you can't see you see through, transparent in the sense of you would see through any ideas of here, there, or in between. And no location, and therefore no possibility of grasping. And this is the end of suffering. Mind itself is Buddha. The Buddhas spoken of here are no other than Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha, this particular historical Buddha, is the mind itself is Buddha. When all Buddhas in the past, present, and future are Buddhas, they unfailingly become Shakyamuni Buddha. This is mind itself is Buddha. So, if mind itself is Buddha, then Shakyamuni Buddha is Buddha. All sentient beings are Buddha. One mind is Buddha. One mind is Shakyamuni Buddha. This very being is it. We are Shakyamuni Buddha. There's no separation. All Buddhas unfailingly become Shakyamuni Buddha. This is mind itself as Buddha. This has been many, many words these days. Many sky flowers have been created, as Dogen would say. But do you have some sense of how to practice with this very mind as Buddha, mind itself as Buddha? I hope that this teaching is a practice encouragement, and we see, things always come full circle, and the practice is always the same practice in the end, but approaching it from all these different angles that sound very strange and different at first, maybe as we investigate them deeper, they seem to reveal the same practice and same realization again and again. But because they're different words are used, they remind us in different ways of something that can sound very obscure and complicated, but in the end, very, very simple. This very being is it. It's just that we have such strong tendency to add something extra, like the belief that it must be obscure and very difficult. It's one of them. And the belief that it must be very easy and like already doing it. There's another one. So, going straight ahead for the rest of this day, just sitting, walking, eating, chanting, nothing extra, including the worry that are we adding something extra? If everything's included, then nothing's extra. Any final thoughts? That mind itself is Buddha. So I just want to mention how, as well as inspired by reading Dogen and having the chance to investigate thoroughly, study exhaustively, line by line, such a teaching. When doing so, I often feel, in the end, very humbled by Dogen's teaching and the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors. And that it's so, I think, so awesome how they present Dharma and their compassionate wish to help us be free over and over again in all these numerous kinds of ways, and that that humility that arises from such study is a great encouragement for me to continue practicing, just endlessly practicing, endlessly revealing Dharma, endlessly opening the mind to the mind as Buddha. And I deeply appreciate all of you being here and your sincerity and dedication to sitting through these long, rambling talks and through the rest of Sesshin, all of it. It takes all of us to create a Sesshin like this. So, may we continue forever. And may all living beings deeply trust, open to, aspire, actualize, and verify mind itself as Buddha. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Visions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Karma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.